You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show...
This morning, prior to the European Council, we signed the political provisions of the association agreement between the European Union and Ukraine.
The EU President Herman Van Rompuy announces Europe is trying to bring Ukraine closer into the fold. James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci will join me in the studio to discuss that and the day's other most important stories, including a Taliban attack kills nine in a Kabul hotel. We'll ask how much is this linked to Pakistan's truce with the Islamist group. And France's embattled former president speaks out against his critics and allegations of corruption. But is anyone listening? Then, later in the programme... We'll find out what happens when a journalist dared himself to play the French horn to concert level in less than a year, and then how his journey made it to the stage. All that, plus we'll play you a little bit of music, and we'll take a look at the cinema too. That's Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So lots and lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The European Union has signed a deal with Ukraine, originally rejected by the former President Viktor Yanukovych. It paves the way for closer trade and political links. European Union leaders have also agreed to expand sanctions against Russia for annexing Crimea. But Andrei Kelin, Russia's ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, says events in Crimea will not be reversed.
Crimean Peninsula has become, since Monday, part of the Russian Federation. And this is a great historical event because this land belonged to Russia since Ekaterina II. We in Russia, we are very proud of this fact.
Well, Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, fears the standoff between Russia and the West over Ukraine could destroy efforts to agree a long-term deal on Iran's nuclear program.
What's being mooted is that Russia says, well, instead of helping to try to sort out the nuclear thing, we'll say, all right, Iran, we'll build you a reactor and we'll barter oil for it. In other words, what Lavrov was threatening was to put a spanner in the works in the most appalling way.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has warned Russia that it could face far-reaching consequences if it sent troops into Ukraine after that Crimea referendum that he said was carried out under the barrel of a Kalashnikov. Meanwhile, Russia's stock markets are down as investors took fright at a US decision to slap sanctions on the inner circle of Russia President Vladimir Putin. Other news now, and the jailed Kurdish militant leader Abdullah Öcalan called on Friday for the Turkish government to establish a legal foundation for peace talks to end a 30-year bloody conflict. Turkey's top intelligence officials launched peace talks with Öcalan in 2012 that led to a ceasefire a year ago, but the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has put the peace process on hold in order to deal with a corruption scandal, one of the biggest crises of his 11-year rule. The international team searching for the missing Malaysia Airlines flight in the remote southern Indian Ocean has failed to find anything so far. Officials leading the search for possible debris seen on satellite photographs that could be from the missing airliner say it may take some time to locate the items and they may have sunk by the time they get there. The flight went missing almost 2 weeks ago with 239 people on board. Five aircraft and several ships are involved in trying to find the possible debris. The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott hopes they can make some progress.
It could just be a container that's fallen off a ship. We just don't know, but we owe it to the families and the friends and the loved ones of the almost 240 people on flight MH370 to do everything we can to try to resolve what is as yet an extraordinary riddle.
Investigations are continuing in Afghanistan into how four gunmen managed to enter a luxury hotel in the capital Kabul before killing nine people. Four foreigners were among the victims. The four Taliban gunmen who launched the attack were killed after security forces took control of the building. Sadiq Siddiqui is a spokesman for Afghanistan's Interior Ministry.
Unfortunately, nine people were also killed by the attackers. four of them foreigners from New Zealand, one from Canada, and one from Pakistan and India. And also five others were Afghans, among them two children and two women, and there were six others wounded.
And finally, when a scrap metal dealer from the US Midwest bought a golden ornament at a junk market, it never crossed his mind that he was the owner of a $20 million Fabergé egg hailing from the court of Imperial Russia. The 3-inch golden egg was spirited out of St. Petersburg after the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution and then disappeared for decades in the United States, but it has now been found and has made that metal dealer very rich. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're with Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 14.06 in New York. Now, Crimea may be lost, but today European Union leaders have signed an agreement on closer relations with Ukraine. The EU Association Agreement offers economic and political support to the interim government in Kiev. The Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, has called this an historic day, adding that Ukraine wants to be part of the big European family. So where is this going to lead everywhere? Where is this going to lead? To talk about this and other stories from today, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. James Boyes, Senior Fellow at King's College London, and Raffaello Pantucci, who's a Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Gentlemen, you're with me for the next 30 minutes, so let's crack on apace with Ukraine. The EU Association Agreement, this was something that should, James, have been signed last year. It was almost there, and then things took a very big turn for the worst. The climate is very different now. What kind of agreement are we looking at now?
Oh, you noticed things turned for the worse, did you?
Just a
I almost missed that. No, you're absolutely right. It is remarkable. What I take from this is really interesting. Just at the very moment that the West looks like it's on the verge of potentially losing Ukraine, what are we going to do? We're going to potentially bump a whole load of money in there. People are talking about this as a Marshall Aid plan for Ukraine. One wonders whether we're not making a huge mistake here. We're almost making this even more of an attractive target for potentially for Putin to come along. It's almost like we're going to basically rescue the country just for him to come along and go, oh, thank you very much. I want that ticket back. And it's a much wealthier country than it was 6 months beforehand.
Raffaella, do you agree?
I don't know. I think that this has been something that's been on the cards for a while. I mean, in a way, this the whole discussion around the association deal was part of the trigger for the initial trouble. Yeah. And the reason the Russians got very agitated about what was happening. But I mean, Ukraine has long been in this sort of awkward position where on the one hand, the European Union has seen it as a sort of potential next successor state. And then on the other hand, you've got this sort of relationship with Russia and this complicated internal politics, which they haven't quite been able to rationalize. I mean, what we're seeing here in some ways, I think, is the EU trying to basically, the one lever that the EU does have and can actually exert is its economic power. When we're talking about hard military power, they really can't do anything about it. So when the Russians start rattling their sabers, sending troops into Crimea, hinting that they might go into eastern Ukraine, Europe may talk a lot about this, but practically speaking, it's difficult to know exactly what they're going to do. However, the economic side of the equation is something that the EU does have and has a long track record of trying to use as a sort of lever to exert authority.
It's using its economic lever, as you're saying, Raffaella. But James, what is it inheriting? By all accounts, an economic basket case left a mess by Yanukovych. So strongly economically dependent on Russia, not least for its fuel.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the great dilemma. You know, we look at this situation, we think, well, how do you come back against what it is that's Putin doing? And as Raffaella rightly pointed out, you don't have a military option at this point, so you try and play the economic card. But what can you really do there when you realise just how important Gazprom is, for example, in that part of the world? One of the things being talked about And Angela Merkel, my understanding is that she's basically said that the G8 is now dead and that she's looking at moving ahead and talking about the G7. That's all well and good. You know, you can start imposing travel bans or some sort of sanctions against Putin's sort of kleptocracy. But one wonders, really, is this really the best that the West can do in terms of defending against what was meant to be a defunct Russia?
What is the best that the West can do, Raffaella?
Well, the best the West can do, that's a very good question. I actually would push back a bit on this notion that Ukraine is a sort of total economic basket and no saving it whatsoever. Yes, clearly gas from Russia is important, but it does have its own domestic hydrocarbon supply, which it could tap if it figured it out a bit better. And, you know, Ukraine used to be considered the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. It
Indeed.
Was where it was a huge agricultural economy.
And still is, and Moscow does take an awful lot of its food from that area.
Exactly, and, you know, food sort of shortages and sort of the shrinking of arable land in other parts of Europe is something that's been a problem for a while. I mean, also the Chinese have sort of been exploring various deals that they might be looking at within Ukraine. So I'm not sure that I would say this is a total economic basket. I think the real problem here is that we've had a very troubled government over a long period of time, which has, as we saw with the sort of with the opening up of Yanukovych's house, you know, was frankly being stolen. There was a sort of substantial kleptocratic government, which was frankly taking a lot of the money. So I think there's clearly something, there is some wealth within this country. It's a matter of figuring out how it can properly be allocated. But at the moment, you're dealing with a very sort of febrile situation and a country which owes huge amounts of money to the international community.
To what degree is this being done not just to embrace Ukraine, which was something that was, you know, they were keen to do last year, but to really try and poke it, to stick it in the eye to Vladimir Putin? Because it does, you know, it is under the EU banner that all this is being brought in. But of course, EU has NATO.
This is true. And this is one of the great fears all along. I was very fortunate. I was chatting to a guy called Charlie Kupchan a couple of months ago, who used to work on Clinton's National Security Council. And he was saying then, before this was all kicking off, that one of the great fears when you expand NATO in the 1990s was, do you basically do this at the risk of humiliating Russia? And well, when Russia was being led by someone like Boris Yeltsin, that's one thing. You know, the great dancing bear to some degree. When you have someone like Vladimir Putin leading, trying very much to reassert, it would appear, Russia on the world stage, then that all of a sudden raises all great problems. So the idea that the 90s has been and gone, I think, is a mistake. And what we're looking at here is a pushback against the very sort of expansionist policies that we saw under Clinton, with potential ramifications which we could all be living with for a very long time, I think.
Well, let's think and now consider what a future with a pivot towards Europe might mean for the people who live in Ukraine. Earlier on, the EU president, Herman Van Rompuy, was talking about his hopes for what an interim government could offer.
Before the ceremony, the president of the European Commission and myself, we had a meeting with the Prime Minister Yatsenyuk of Ukraine, who assured us that his government was focusing on answering the people's call for an open and a modern Ukraine. To achieve these economic and democratic reform, and above all, inclusiveness, are essential. And I'm confident that the Ukrainian government and people will succeed on this path.
How eager are the Ukrainian people, Raffaella Panticci, to succeed on this path that Herman Van Rompuy was mentioning there? Of course, the Ukrainians have a long memory when it comes to its relationship with the likes of Stalin, who massacred, you know, and what he did to them. Are they really genuinely fleeing towards Europe now as fast as they can?
I think it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that. I think there is a constituency within the country who do clearly want to be part of the European Union and part of that warm embrace. But I think this goes to the fundamental problem that you do have within Ukraine, which is a country which has a sort of divided identity, if you will. You have the sort of more Ukrainian population and the more Russian population, and then you have Tartars and many others sort of scattered around in between. But fundamentally, you do have this sort of division. And, you know, this is not a minority that we're talking about, which is, you know, less than 10%. We're talking almost 50% of the country would lean more in a Russian direction than the other. So, you know, that fundamentally cuts to the problems, and we're talking about democracies, and democracy should be collect, you know, the choice of the mass, of the majority. And if you're dealing with a country which is so divided, when half of them, and they are now the people in charge who want to go towards Europe, then yes, they seem to be rushing towards it. But they're always going to have this drag of the other half of the country who would rather not be.
James, it is the first time, I think, in my memory that I have seen the EU act assertively with teeth and in a collective way, in a very positive way, and in a way in which it wants to position itself perhaps not necessarily as a rival as the US, but as a political body as powerful as the US.
And yet, what is it actually doing that's positive? Just to give you an idea, our esteemed presenter has just shrugged. This is the great challenge. It's talking the great talk. But if you remember, it tried to do the same thing with Bosnia many, many years ago. And a lot of people criticised both George H.W. Bush and initially Bill Clinton for not getting involved in Bosnia. But they've been told categorically, this is the hour of Europe, don't get involved. Here we now have Europe trying to talk the talk with regard to what's happening with Russia in this part of the world. But fundamentally, what's it going to do? I don't think somehow that Vladimir Putin is lying awake at night in his Kremlin apartment, shaking with fear about what it is that some faceless diplomats are going to be doing out of Brussels necessarily. If and when this comes to a pushback, it's not going to come out of Brussels, it's going to come out of Washington, D.C.
You're nodding in agreement, Rafael.
Well, I'm not so sure. I wonder. I mean, I think one of the interesting elements for me in this whole discussion has been Poland's role. Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, has really been front and center in this whole debate in terms of pushing the European line forwards. And I think in some ways, what we're seeing here within the sort of European Union context is a greater assertiveness from the Eastern members, who until now had kind of been rolled over by the big three, frankly, Germany. That's another discussion, you know, Germany, France and the UK, who would very much sort of steer European foreign policy. But I think what's interesting here is you're seeing Poland is managing to catch this wave and managing to really get Merkel and France sort of on board to push back against Russia and actually produce some sort of a coherent line. I think, you know, in many ways that speaks a very positive sign for European foreign policy, though I accept James's point that, you know, we haven't really seen them, you know, manning the ramparts, and I don't think this is making Vladimir Putin quake in his boots quite yet. But I do think that we are seeing a more assertive European Union to some degree, and I do think part of that is the fact that you're seeing countries like Poland in the East who feel a greater sense of identity and strength within the Union.
There is something you just mentioned there that I'd quite like to pick up on, which you're talking about trying to gain consensus throughout Europe, and of course you mentioned Angela Merkel. To what degree, James, do you think that Merkel could actually be a linchpin in this? She could be the one who can talk to Putin because she speaks Russian.
Well, that won't hurt.
And that doesn't hurt.
And of course Vladimir speaks German. So.
Of course, because he was stationed as an FSB agent.
Exactly. KGB back then.
KGB. Same job. Three. Go on,
So if you look into his eyes, you would see KGB, KGB, KGB.
Like a slice of rock, what would imagine it be right through the
Merkel's got a very good position to play here. And quite frankly, if it comes down to Angela Merkel or, heaven forbid, Baroness Ashton fronting the Western approach to the Kremlin, I know where I'd put my money, quite frankly. I think she's a formidable individual and someone who could really well emerge as a real world leader at this point and very much sort of eclipse the role that I think David Cameron would just desperately love to play in this position.
Wouldn't he just? Very briefly, because we must move on to our next subject, but waiting on the sidelines of this, the actors from earlier on this week of the United States imposing their sanctions on a limited number of individuals, all of whom seem to be incredibly close to Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. It's a very clever move. To what degree do you think that the United States and Europe can now work in tandem? Because they seem to be going in slightly different directions.
Yeah, I don't think there's an awful lot of joined up thinking here. I know there might be stuff going on behind the scenes that we're not particularly well aware of, but I think that one of the problems you have is that John Kerry at the moment is trying to carry an awful lot of water. He's trying to deal with the situation with regards to Russia and Ukraine. He's clearly trying to position himself for his Nobel Prize in the Middle East. And I think as a result of that, perhaps there are things which are slipping between the cracks. It was at this point that, you know, Obama did a real good move, I thought, when he first came to power, which was to put regional specialists, people like Richard Holbrooke, for example, into places in AFPAC. And it's a real shame, I think, that he's not carried on with that approach in his second term.
You mentioned AFPAC there. Let us head to there now. Let's leave Ukraine for the moment. I'm sure we will return very soon. But let's head to Afghanistan now, where 9 people have died, including 2 children, after gunmen opened fire in a hotel in Kabul. Not only was it carried out in the run-up to next month's elections, an increasing number of Afghans, including the outgoing president, Hamid Karzai, believe Pakistan's current ceasefire with the Taliban is leading to more attacks over the border in Afghanistan. Let's start with you on this, Raffaello. To what degree is the Pakistani truce with the ceasefire with the Taliban contributing to this increasing number of attacks, all of them horrible and violent and cleverly targeted in Afghanistan?
I think it's very difficult to know. I mean, frankly, the Afghans always say that Pakistanis are behind every attack. This is sort of a well-worn trope. I think the fact that they're specifically linking it to this truce, something of a truce that we're seeing in Pakistan, seems potential possible, but I would wonder a little bit about the specific causality of the one or the other. I think it is interesting that we are seeing the Taliban willing to target really civilian targets in the city. This is, I think, the second or third we've seen already this year. While, yes, there are regular attacks in Kabul, they don't usually look like this. It is somewhat rare for them to attack such a soft target, because the reaction to this sort of incident will be that foreigners will stop sort of trying to go around Kabul, and you'll see institutions like the UN sort of pulling out or making their people move back ever further into compounds, which of course has an impact on the city and on Afghanistan's ability to sort of engage in the international community. And that targeting doesn't actually happen that much in Kabul. It is quite rare. So the fact that we're seeing so many already this year suggests that we're really seeing an effort by the Taliban to try to scare these people off, which presumably is part of trying to undermine the Afghan government. The direct link with Pakistan, I wonder. I mean, we also saw after some of the earlier attacks this year, Karzai apparently has a list of incidents that he says have been caused, in fact, by the Americans.
Of course.
So I'm always I always wonder a little about these sort of causal links. And, you know, within these sorts of discussions in Afghanistan, it's always a shadow within a shadow as to who's actually responsible. But I think it is a very brutal attack. And I think it's demonstrative of a trend that we're seeing, which is really quite disturbing, especially in the run up to the elections.
Rafaela just mentioned a host of possible groups behind or reasons mm-hmm. why these attacks are coming thick and fast. James, what are your thoughts?
I wouldn't want to claim to be a specialist in that part of the world, but I will suggest that I think there's going to be very few people who are going to be sad to see the back of Hamid Karzai, considering some of the statements he's come out with in recent weeks and months, if not going on for years now. When you think about how long we've been investing in Afghanistan, we're now in 2014, we're going back to 2001 now, it's over a dozen years. You think about the treasure and the cost that's been pumped into Afghanistan, it still is very little more than a flailed state at this point. One wonders what on earth is going to happen to this country when the West does eventually pull out very, very shortly. Why anybody would be going to Kabul, quite frankly, at this point, unless they absolutely needed to be, is beyond me. There is some remarkable reporting coming out in the New York Times this week with regard to the ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which I hope we can get to talk about. There's no doubt, I think, that this idea that the United States and the West perhaps have been fighting the wrong enemy, to use the title of the forthcoming book, is becoming more and more clear in that part of the world.
Let's move on. Well, let's explore this article that you just mentioned from the International New York Times, written by Carlotta Gould. It appeared in the last couple of days. Makes a very, very explicit link between the then President Pervez Musharraf and the allegations of his direct influence over the Taliban. I think the words maintaining and controlling are mentioned. Raffaello, this is no great surprise, though, is it really? Or is the closeness of the link what's interesting about this?
I think the accusation that's really fascinating about this is the fact that the ISI had a desk and a specific desk officer with a team who was specifically looking after bin Laden and making sure whatever he was doing, they were sort of aware of, which is quite a substantial accusation. I think the other interesting element that comes out of this article is this discussion that the ISI, on the one hand, were hunting Al-Qaeda and yes. Taliban elements, while on the other hand, they were protecting them. And that, I think, would match up quite tidily with what you've seen in terms of what's going on in Pakistan at the moment. It is quite clear there are some groups that are connected to the state, that are controlled by the state and probably the deep state, which is essentially the ISI. I think on the other hand, however, you have got a group, and it isn't mentioned in this article, but I suspect it probably is mentioned in the longer book of which it's a part of, looking at the Tehrik-i-Taliban, which is essentially the Pakistani Taliban, which is a group that really emerged out of an incident that they talk about in this article, which is the incident of the Red Mosque, when some students sort of took over the mosque in the middle of Islamabad, and it led to a commando raid on the place, you know, right in the heart of the sort of capital city, and it caused a huge roar. But anyway, from that incident, you saw the Pakistani Taliban emerge as an organization. And this organization has repeatedly launched substantial attacks against the Pakistani state, including the ISI. And so the problem, I think, with Pakistan and this whole conversation is it's clear that someone in the ISI knew and has some control over this connection. But there's also a part of that connection they don't really have a control over. And that's the difficult part, is that, in fact, from an outsider's perspective, it's all very much part of one mass. But I think from an internal perspective, it's a very complicated one where they really have some relationships they have some leverage over, but others they really don't.
Is that massively surprising, though, given just the splintered nature of the Taliban and the geographic nature of the fact that the Taliban is spread over two countries and has, you know, it is effectively a tribal organization.
No, I think that's right. It is a very, it's not entirely surprising you're seeing playing out like this, but I think the fact that you've got, on the one hand, that's the sort of the insurgent side of it, but in terms of their support network within the sort of Pakistani state, it's clear that they've got a very complicated relationship as well. And then from the outsider's perspective, who do we then deal with and who are we able to deal with in some sort of useful way? There's a fascinating element here where they refer to Ahmed Shuja Pasha, the former head of the ISI, and saying that he specifically knew, and the US had direct intelligence, that he knew where bin Laden was located. At the same time, Shuja Pasha was seen as the great, you know, American, they loved him. They thought he was a great leader of the ISI. They thought he was their great supporter. So the fact that even this man, who they saw as a great ally, was in fact cognizant and aware of Osama bin Laden's location within Pakistan, I think shows the real complexity of this relationship. And also shows, what are we actually going to do about it? How much can we really lean and rely on Pakistan to actually resolve this problem when they're so fundamentally conflicted about it with themselves?
You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, joined by James Boyes and Raffaella Pantucci. We return in a moment when we turn our attention to Thailand.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time in Bangkok is 1:26 a.m. Here in London, it's 18:26. Now, Thailand's Constitutional Court has declared last month's general elections invalid. It's no great surprise given the disruption to the voting process by the anti-government protesters. But what does it mean for the Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawat, who called the snap election? Well, on today's briefing, we spoke to our Bangkok correspondent, Gwen Robinson.
So far, she's shown every intention of hanging on until the very grim, very bitter end, if it comes indeed. For now, I would think that she's going to continue to put up a fight. And indeed, as I said before, why should she step down? Just, it has been one blow after another, but she did win an enormous majority in her election in 2011. Clearly, the various institutions, including the courts, are against this government, and you've had one ruling after another by various courts and commissions, including right now the Anti-Corruption Commission, is also expected soon to rule against her implication for responsibility for corruption in a controversial rice subsidy scandal.
Our lady in Bangkok there, Gwen Robinson, listening to that with my studio guests, Dr. James Boyce and Raffaello Pantucci, joining me for the next few minutes at least to unpick this story that's coming out of Thailand. James, this is no great surprise. Perhaps there's a surprise that it's come from the Constitutional Court. It's a great triumph of the rule of law. But given the pandemonium that was the February the 2nd elections, is anybody that shocked that they are invalid?
I don't think so. I think if you listen to the reports that are coming out, some of which you just repeated there, there is a suggestion. I think this is somewhat expected. The question now is, of course, where do we go from here? I think it was Stalin who once said, it's not who votes that counts, it's who counts the votes that counts. Something which I always stand by, quite frankly. And I think we just have to wait and see what transpires in this part of the world, because clearly at the moment, there's a great deal of pandemonium coming out.
Raffaello, your thoughts?
I would agree with James. I think it's a very chaotic situation. I mean, we saw the protests last year. I mean, in some ways, they ended with some violence and a substantial number of deaths. So it was clear that some sort of election was going to have to happen. But I don't think it's really shaken itself out how it's what the sort of final conclusion is. This is essentially an extension of Thaksin and Shinawat's problems back in the day, part of the reason why he left. It's just kind of this unrolling process. I suppose the question is, at what point does this turn to violence on a more substantial scale? You've already got a sort of low-level insurgency happening down in the south of Thailand. Is it possible that this sort of political chaos in the capital, Bangkok, would spill over into broader violence? It's very difficult to know. I can't imagine that this ruling is really going to help matters.
No, we have seen quite sporadic but rather targeted violence in the last couple of weeks. A lot of the anti-government protests have been attacked with the likes of grenades and gunmen as well have attacked them. But just looking at the way that Thailand now moves as an international, how dare I say it, an international brand. It is a country which in many ways has managed to maintain its attraction for its tourist destinations because they seem to be relatively unaffected by all this. But when you look at Thailand and in particular Bangkok, that seems to be damaged. How long do you think this damage is going to last?
I think that's a very difficult one to call because, of course, the question becomes how long is it we're going to have this sort of instability before some sort of political leadership comes out that obviously has a wide enough sort of public support base to be able to allow an environment which is conducive for international investment and business. But I think it's the question about whether tourism will get affected is a very interesting one because I think a substantial portion of the Thai economy relies on this tourist trade. And if this violence continues, people, I remember talking to a friend in Singapore, I think it was, who said that he had cancelled his holiday to Thailand specifically because he was sort of uncertain of the chaos. And this was before we saw all the sort of total violence that we saw in the street protests and the deaths.
And finally, very briefly, we have to touch upon Nicolas Sarkozy's breaking his year-long silence since he lost the president election a couple of May ago. He's been responding against corruption allegations. He was, of course, investigated at the moment for allegedly funding his 2007 campaign with money from Muammar Gaddafi. He's answered claims that he abused the aide of the L'Oreal heiress Bettencourt as well, extorting from funds from her for political means. James D. Boyes, what happens to a man or a woman, well, man so thus far, when you go to the Elysee Palace, do you lose all sense of, responsibility?
I think that if we've learned anything over the last couple of years, Emma, it does not pay to be an ex-leader of any country whatsoever. quite clearly, we're not going to be hearing from the mad colonel himself with regards to this. So the best we can perhaps do is to rely upon the words of the rather diminutive Mr. Sarkozy. But quite clearly, it really doesn't pay. Once you've gained office and you lose power, I think it's very, very clear that there's an awful lot of an attempt to line one's pockets. We're seeing something very, very similar coming out of South Africa, for example, at the moment. The idea that perhaps politicians are in some ways all very much in the same sort of boat of making sure that they, at the very least, do well out of their own term in office shouldn't really surprise any of us who've studied politics for a while.
I'm trying to think who's done well out of it. I'd probably argue Bill Clinton's done better than anyone out of it.
He's not done too bad.
He's done all right, and so is his wife not doing too badly.
Yeah, his daughter, right.
Finally, Raffaello, do we care?
Well, I think, you know, Sarkozy does make for interesting news coverage. And it is, you know, this idea, it does feed into this bigger conversation about, you know, people listening into other people's phone calls. I think, you know, I thought an interesting point Sarkozy did make in this was the fact that if he had given money to Gaddafi, wouldn't Gaddafi have used this against him before he bombed the country? Which I suppose is a valid point. The other interesting element, which I thought in this whole phone debate with this phone tapping story with Sarkozy was the earlier story that apparently Carla Bruni had been involved in some sort of cabinet meetings.
Right.
And apparently she was quite an active participant in some of them, which is a sort of interesting detail to come up.
Oh, to have been a fly on. I know they taped quite a few, someone who taped quite a few of the meetings. I would have loved to have heard that. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. James Boyce and Raffaella Pantucci dreaming of Carla Bruni serenading them on her guitar during a meeting. Thank you very much for joining me here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Ahead in the next half hour, we get the latest news from Capitol Hill and we meet a man who learned to play the horn, the French horn, very quickly. Before we get started on all that with the time at 33 minutes past the hour, Jonathan has the latest.
Thank you very much. The European Union has signed a deal with Ukraine, originally rejected by the former president, Viktor Yanukovych. It paves the way for closer trade and political links. European Union leaders have also agreed to expand sanctions against Russia for annexing Crimea. The jailed Kurdish militant leader Abdullah Öcalan called on Friday for the Turkish government to establish a legal foundation for peace talks to end a 30-year bloody conflict. Turkey's top intelligence officials launched peace talks with Öcalan in 2012 that led to a ceasefire a year ago, but the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has put the peace process on hold. The international team searching for the missing Malaysia Airlines flight in the remote southern Indian Ocean has so far failed to find anything. Officials leading the search for possible debris seen on satellite photographs that could be from the missing airliner say it may take time to locate the items and they may have sunk by the time they get there. And investigations are still continuing in Afghanistan into how four gunmen managed to enter a luxury hotel in the capital, Kabul, before killing nine people. Four foreigners were among the victims. And that's the latest news so far on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of today's news. After that, Marcus Hippie will be there here for this week's episode of The Menu, so do stay tuned for that if you can. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and the time is 35 minutes past the hour. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We catch up with Sasha Eisenberg, our Washington correspondent, who just happens to be in LA today. Hi, Sasha. Where are we starting, LA or Washington?
Oh, we can start in Washington. Yeah, I always like a good municipal election, and there's a mayor's race in Washington this year that has the sort of delightful complication of the mayor now being very much implicated in a corruption investigation about how it turns out he probably was involved in illegally financing his last campaign. So the next month is going to be pretty interesting because he's Vince Gray has said that he will not step down, even if he's charged.
This is a question of timing, isn't it? Because he says he's not going to step down, but there's no sign or no clear sign that an indictment is imminent either. Is this a sort of a waiting game that must now take place?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a sort of slow, roiling waiting game for all 4 years of his administration. The scandal goes back to a question as to whether there unquestionably was a sort of illegal independent campaign financed by a businessman with city interests when Gray ran for the first time in 2010. And this businessman, Jeffrey Thompson, is now has been cooperating with the federal investigators for a while. And it's always been one step removed from Gray. Thompson was just charged recently and says that Gray knew about it, that he met with Gray, who signed off on all of this outside spending. And so this has been a sort of, you know, looming problem for Gray for 4 years, but now that Thompson is actually been formally charged, it's pretty urgent. And a lot of other politicians who were afraid of touching this, including the several people who are running against Gray, are sort of happy to make it an issue in the field. And you know, the debates that are taking place are now very much about corruption instead of about economic growth or school reform or some of the other issues that that would have taken center stage otherwise.
I was going to say, to what degree is this now dominating any kind of campaign?
Yeah, it's sort of, everybody needs to respond to it in different ways. And Washington, D.C., you may remember Marion Barry, who was the mayor in the late 80s, early 90s, ended up getting charged for doing crack while he was mayor before this was cool in North America. The first great crack smoking mayor was in Washington, D.C. There's been a sort of long history of corruption, all of it sort of racially very delicate. The city is very much sort of riven along black and white lines and class lines. And so I think for a lot of white politicians in the city, there was a fear of looking like they were piling on too quickly on Gray, who is black. Now that the feds have basically acknowledged that they think he was complicit in this, a lot of his opponents aren't holding back the way that they had before.
Let's move on to an article in Politico magazine, which, frankly, when I saw, I wasn't entirely sure why they commissioned. It's all to do with a lady called Elizabeth Wahl, who, until a few weeks ago, nobody outside anybody in a hotel room watching Russia Today might have seen. She suddenly hit the headlines because she resigned on air over President Putin's actions in Ukraine, saying that she could not be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin. When a lot of people saw this, I think, I wonder if you had the same feeling as I, that you thought, you clever, clever girl.
Yes, and now there's some reporting that sort of bears it out. She was, she did this sort of martyrdom thing perfectly, and this clip, and as you acknowledge, nobody watches Russia Today, so probably more people see the YouTube clips of from it than ever see it live. But she did this very dramatic, seemingly heartfelt, courageous thing of quitting her job on air. Well, some reporting has come out that suggests that she'd basically been kept off the air for 6 months, had been looking for a new job altogether, was not a particularly happy employee, and may have sort of strategized how to dramatically take herself out of her job while being able to leverage it for some new PR. And so as the sort of investigation of the circumstances behind her coming out, she's sort of definitely confirmed that you can get good PR by quitting on claims of principle. And so, you know, everybody who worked with her said she was not at all political before. It looks like there was an opportunity to build a career off pretending that she was.
What has been the reaction in Washington, given the fact that she will probably now be heading that way, or to any large TV network trying to say, look, I'm the famous anchor who quit because I'm a true American?
You know, I think people have always found RT a sort of wonderful curiosity in the U.S. They, you know, relatively well-funded, obviously, and so a lot of folks in the media know who they are because, frankly, we get invited to go on, and they act like a normal professional TV network, and I know for a lot of my peers, young journalists or people at think tanks, it ends up becoming a sort of trial stage. You know, you can get, like, free media training going on this network that nobody watches. So nobody was really paying attention to her or this network or could have named anybody on it before this. And my guess is she'll have a very quick window in which she is held up as a matter of some interest or curiosity, and she'd better get her Fox News contract while that window is still open.
Well, we wish her very well. Sasha Eisenberg, our Washington correspondent, speaking from LA today, just in case you're interested. Thank you very much indeed. Up next, we talk to the journalist and author Jasper Rees about the challenges of staging a play about oneself. Stay tuned to find out more.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. It isn't uncommon for people to dream or indeed think about embracing a new challenge or taking up a new hobby or pastime. How many of these ambitions ever come to fruition is, of course, a very different story. But my next guest decided not only to take up an instrument, he picked a French horn, particularly difficult by all accounts, he challenged himself to play it to concert level, I understand, and perform it within a year. Jasper Rees then wrote a book about his experience, and now a play is just about to start in the West End here in London. Jasper is clearly a busy man, an overachiever if ever I met one, but he joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Jasper.
Hi.
Now, where do we start with this story? Because you're a journalist who learnt to play the French horn, who wrote a book about it, and then a play has been written about it, which you're currently experiencing. Let's start with the French horn. What was it? What possessed you?
Well, I, like many people, learnt my instrument as a child. I'm sure you learnt an instrument, Emma, when you were young, and you may still play it. Who knows?
Sadly not.
All right, okay.
It was a recorder and it didn't go very far.
Well, there we go. You know, you see, you did start a recorder. Imagine if you'd carried on your recorder for 7 years and then you'd stopped when you left school, and then at the age of 39 and three quarters you thought, my life is has a recorder-shaped hole in it. And I had a similar experience with the French horn. I decided that I had this urge to take it up again. And you could call it a midlife crisis, I guess. It was a midlife crisis, which was not classically enacted with the aid of a Harley Davidson, but with a French horn instead.
It is nonetheless a big jump from taking up a hobby to then deciding to play it to the level that you did, because it must have been incredibly tough and you must have wondered why you were doing it at some point.
Well, there is no recording that actually will tell us how well or otherwise I actually played when I did do this performance. But I mean, the thing really started with the fact that, as you mentioned, I'm a journalist, and I did write an article about going to a gathering of an organisation which is amusingly known as the British Horn Society.
Right.
They have a festival every year, and I went along to this festival and played in a huge, what's known as a kind of massed horn blow. And we played the Hallelujah chorus, 70 of us. And I wrote this article about it, and lots of people, I had more feedback than I normally get from writing arts journalism, people saying, oh, I wish I hadn't given up my instrument. And it clearly touched a nerve. So I thought, there's something in this. So I decided to see if I could write a book about it, got a deal, and I thought this book needs to have an ending. People are going to need to have a reason to read through to the end. So I set myself this target of standing up a year later without the 69 other people and playing a Mozart concerto on my own.
And what was that like?
It was absolutely terrifying. I have never been so scared in my life, and I don't anticipate ever being so scared again.
So when you go to meet your maker, you're at the pearly gate together. That was nothing compared to the Mozart horn concerto.
Well, you know, I mean, let's touch wood here, but you know, I don't face something as scary. But it certainly was extremely, extremely challenging.
I must ask, were you any good in your concert?
I was told by a lot of people, "Oh, you were very brave." And I was brave, actually, because one of the people in the audience was the most famous and most distinguished horn player in the world of the time is a guy called Barry Tuckwell, who I'm sure some of your listeners will have heard of. And most of the people in the audience were horn players who were probably better than me. I played it to the best of my ability.
So you did that, and then not happy to leave that alone. It then becomes a play where the leading character is called Jasper.
Yes. An actor heard the book being read on BBC Radio, and he contacted me immediately and said, "That's my story. Can we do a play?" And about 4 months later, this one-man play was up and running at a fringe festival in Aldborough. In Suffolk, and the play just sort of seemed to catch a thermal, because I think people enjoyed the story, and the actor is Jonathan Guy Lewis, who is brilliant. I had to stand up and play the horn once in front of an audience. He, being an actor, is absolutely thrilled to do it, you know, as many times as is required. And he's doing it again, in a fringe West End theatre.
To what degree is the Jasper that was written, the Jasper who wrote the book and who learned to play the French horn, the Jasper that you will see in this play, which is called What I Found My Horn?
It is called I Found My Horn. I should say where that comes from. There's a song, a cabaret song by a duo called Flanders and Swan, whom many of your listeners will know of. And they wrote a song to the tune of another Mozart concerto, not the one I play, called An Ill Wind. And it has it has this couplet: "To sound my horn, I had to develop my embouchure. I found my horn was a bit of a devil to play." So that's where I got the title from. Is it me, or is it... It's a sort of mixture of me and Jonathan now, actually. But it's my story. It's the architecture of the narrative is mine. You know, the challenge of setting yourself this task and meeting all these horn mentors, which I did, and going to an amusing place in New Hampshire called Horn Camp, that all happened to me. But some of the personal stuff has been fictionalized, because I had no wish to invade my privacy. So we've invented a kind of family life, for a broken family life, it should be added, for this character, which isn't really me at all. There's a mild overlap, but it mostly is me.
It must be very strange to sit next to an actor and talk to an actor who is trying to be you. What kind of conversations do you have between yourselves?
It's a kind of mental tug of war, and it's been going on for a while. And it's very funny. We both feel that we possess this thing, because, I mean, oddly, when I see Jonathan getting an ovation, and sometimes a standing ovation, and people cheering him and saying, "Well done, you," and I must say, I do feel conflicted and think, well, actually, that's me you're clapping out there.
Have you ever been tempted to stand up in the audience and wave?
Every night. No. He deserves it. He's the one who goes out and actually sweats the bullets, whereas I just sit back there and watch.
Jasper Rees, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the programme. Jasper's play, I Found My Horn, will be on stage at the Trafalgar Studios in London from April the 1st to April the 3rd. Catch it while you can.
May the 3rd.
A whole month. A whole month of horn playing. Fantastic. Time now for a bit of music. No French horn, I'm afraid to say, but since we're in a slightly reflective mood, here's Me, Myself and I by Beyoncé. All the ladies, if you feel me, help me sing it out. Beyoncé there, of course, with an old school hit, Me, Myself and I. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:51 here in London. Time now for our weekly review of what's on the silver screen. Today we talk with Dana Stevens, film critic at Slate magazine in the US. A little earlier, Dana caught up with our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco to discuss her picks of the week.
Dana, very good to have you here on Monaco 24. I think let's start with a film that actually I'm very curious to see. The Wind Rises is the new film by Hayao Miyazaki. I mean, have you seen it? Did you like it? Can you tell us a bit more?
Yes, I have complicated feelings about this movie, but yes, I would say overall that I did like it. And if you're at all interested in Hayao Miyazaki, who, in my opinion, is the greatest living maker of animated films, and this is his self-proclaimed last movie, he says that he's now retiring at 73 after making The Wind Rises. So I would definitely send people to see it. However, I would say that with the proviso that if you don't know his work at all and you want to get started on it, I wouldn't necessarily start with The Wind Rises because it's one of his darkest, most difficult, and least accessible movies, and least fun. I mean, this is not a children's movie at all. Although it's animated and the main character is a young man who's interested in airplanes, this is not something to take your aviation mad nephew to because it's actually a very dark movie about war and earthquakes and typhus and all sorts of horrible things that befell Japan in the mid-20th century. It's a biopic. It's a slightly fictionalized story of an aviation engineer who designed the Zero airplane, which was a Japanese fighter that was used for bombing in World War II. And this movie has been criticized by many groups, especially a lot of Asian groups, for glossing over Japan's role in the wars of the 20th century. But I feel like Miyazaki is dealing with things on a whole different level. I feel like he's taking this grand historical perspective about war and suffering that is sort of outside of politics.
So in The Wind Rises, there's definitely not fantasy like you've seen in Spirited Away and many other films by Miyazaki.
Well, there actually is lots of fantasy. There's a ongoing dream sequence where our hero, Jiro, who is the aviation engineer, interacts with this Italian aviator who is, I think, actually not alive anymore at the time that that the movie takes place, but, you know, is someone that visits Jiro in his dreams and talks to him about aviation. So, yeah, there is lots of beautiful fantasy and animation, and there are some very lyrical scenes, but they alternate with these dark and frightening ones, and, you know, the themes are pretty heavy.
Well, let's listen to a clip from it.
Which world will you choose?
I just want to create beautiful airplanes.
Like that?
So we'll talk about Night Moves, the new film by Kelly Richard. Can you tell us a bit about the story of the film?
Yes, I'm excited for Night Moves to open. It hasn't opened here yet in the US, but it will in a couple of weeks. And I should start by saying that Night Moves has nothing to do with the 1975 Arthur Penn movie with the exact same title, starring Gene Hackman, which is a kind of a detective story. It's not a remake or a reboot in any way. It just stole the title. It's a film by this female director, Kelly Reichardt, who I find very interesting because she does something completely different with every movie. All of her movies have in common that they're sort of slow-paced and thoughtful and a little bit cerebral, but they're all in completely different genres. So, you know, she made one that's a road movie about two male friends who go camping together. She made one about a sort of social realist fable called Wendy and Lucy about a homeless drifter and her dog. And her last movie before Night Moves was called Meek's Cutoff, and it was this very strange avant-garde sort of Western, which I didn't love as much as some people did, but I found very interesting. So Night Moves is her first attempt to make a thriller, and it's an eco-terrorism thriller starring Jesse Eisenberg, Dakota Fanning, and Peter Sarsgaard as this trio of committed ecologists who decide to blow up a dam in Oregon. And I don't want to give anything away about the plot, but it's one of these very meticulous thrillers with very tight focus performances, a lot of tension, arguably somewhat slow moving, but I think that's what gives it the spooky mood that it has. And like Meek's Cutoff, the Western that Kelly Reichardt recently made, it has this very ambiguous, open-ended ending that could be interpreted many different ways by many different viewers, which some might find unsatisfying, but I actually found sort of galvanizingly thoughtful.
Let's listen to a clip of Night Moves then.
Let the revolution begin for the future, for the people, and for the planet.
People are going to start thinking anyway. People are going to start thinking they have to.
Good to see you, brother.
Hey, do you want
to? You think she's all right?
Yeah, she's done some shit. She's good.
She did that thing in Eugene with you, the Siltars?
Yeah.
Carrie Taylor.
Joseph Maka.
Tomorrow, this is who we are. No exceptions.
And now moving on, Dana, let's talk about a film that I believe you're not a big fan, the new Muppets film. Why not? What's the problem with the Muppets?
You know, I just finished debating this with a colleague this morning who did like the new Muppets movie, Muppets Most Wanted, a lot, and was trying to convince me to get off my high horse about it. I mean, it's not that I dislike Muppets Most Wanted. I just don't think it does what it could do with the great Muppet franchise, which is, like a lot of, I think, Americans of my generation, is very dear to my heart. So the Muppets Most Wanted is a sort of throwback to the old caper Muppet movies of the 80s. It's a crime heist movie sort of set against the backdrop of this European tour that the Muppet Show has gone on. And I just felt that the Muppets Most Wanted was a sort of sour take on the Muppet universe. The director, James Bobin, he made the last Muppet movie, which was called Just the Muppets. It came out in 2011 with Jason Segel and Amy Adams. And I felt like, although it was very lighthearted and frivolous, that was a movie that really got the Muppets. It sort of got their anarchic appeal and what it is that makes people just excited to be in their company. And even though it's the same director, one of the same screenwriters, the same musician, Brett McKenzie, who was a member of Flight of the Conchords, who composed the great music for the last movie, it's that same team, but somehow something is missing this time. And I think it has to do with the villain story, which really didn't work for me. Ricky Gervais is the bad guy, and he teams up with this Kermit doppelganger, this frog puppet that looks exactly like Kermit, but is a Russian mafioso criminal. And a whole lot of time is spent on these two criminals and their relationship. And we just don't get enough of the actual felt puppets that we came here to see.
And at the same time, then, why do you think are we still kind of fascinated by the Muppets? You know, because, I mean, they enjoyed some sort of revival in recent years.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. I mean, I don't really have a larger sort of cultural take. I mean, I feel like for a big swath of my generation and the generation surrounding it, there's a lot of nostalgia there, that we just love the Muppet Show from our childhood and we want to see those characters back. But I don't think nostalgia alone would be enough to keep this franchise afloat. I think that what's really kept it going in a way is that people enjoy the return to craft. Maybe we're tired of CGI monsters and robots flying through space and we're just happy to see a plain old proscenium stage set with some cloth puppets putting on a show.
Oh, let's listen to a clip from Muppets Most Wanted, then.
The world's greatest criminal has stolen the greatest treasures, escaped the greatest prisons, and he bears a strong resemblance to someone you know.
It's not easy being mean.
Do you guys think that Kermit's been acting a little weird lately?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. He's never been more caring or devoted to me.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
And that rounds up of our film review between Dana Stevens and Fernanda Augusto Pacheco. And that indeed rounds up today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special studio guests, James Boyes and Raffaello Panticci. My thanks too to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Carlotta Ribello, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Next up, our weekly food and drink hour, The Menu with Marcus Hippie. We'll be finding out where to get the best Mexican food in New York. We'll meet a barman turned entrepreneur who's launched his own spirit, and we'll hear from two friends who are the first Londoners to make and sell their own almond milk. I'll be back in an hour or two with the Monocle Daily with Andrew Miller, but for now, from me, it's Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.